We live longer, we kill each other less, we fight in fewer wars, there's less domestic violence, there's less child abuse, there's less starvation and poverty. There's also a long-standing cultural trend of a culture of victimhood. Oh, unquestionably, you just ask people. They say, I self-censor. Well, we're going to be collectively deluded about certain ideas that might be true, but no one's willing to say.
What was Jeff Epstein like?
I couldn't stand him. I thought he was a bullshitter. I thought he was a kibitzer.
Welcome to another episode of We the 66, the official podcast of the 66% of Americans who do not trust the news.
We are your hosts, Max.
And Max.
So thank you for tuning in to today's very special episode with one of the most influential people in the world, Steven Pinker.
Where to begin with Pinker? He is a Canadian psychologist who's taught at Stanford, MIT, and Harvard, which is where he's been for the last 20 years.
Now, he's best known for a few books that say all sorts of stuff, but mainly this. The world has become a much better place because of what he calls enlightenment values. That's reason, secularism, liberalism, and he says that is pushing the world forward, so we are all much better off than we used to be.
So despite his uplifting message of progress, Steven Pinker has become deeply controversial in recent years with his own side.
He still has his cheerleaders, though. Bill Gates ranked his book Enlightenment Now his favorite book that he has ever read. He's been on Time's list of the 100 most influential people. He's ranked the number 2 most influential thinker in the world by Ranker. He's an extremely important academic.
So we took a road trip to Cambridge, Massachusetts. He welcomed us into his office, which has a lot of books, unsurprisingly, and we talked to him about a lot of different issues.
We asked him if a Harvard degree is worth less than it used to be. We asked him how his students have changed over time, if he self-censors. We asked him what Jeffrey Epstein was like.
So cannot wait for you to hear this conversation, and also make sure to subscribe on YouTube. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify if you are so inclined. And by the way, big news, Will hate it if you give us 5 stars.
Okay, so without further ado, here is Steven Pinker.
Dr. Pinker, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we've got a ton of stuff we've been planning to talk to you about, but then last night you sent out a tweet that caught our attention, which is that you said academia keeps getting stupider and stupider. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was in response to a tweet that said the best thing that President Biden could do for the climate is impose a ceasefire in Gaza, because all of those planes and missiles are causing greenhouse gas emissions. But I mean, if you do the math, this is a small proportion of the problem of climate change. And there are a lot of wars, such as in Ukraine, such as in Ethiopia last year, that have caused far, far more deaths and far more emissions. So it was kind of a political tweet based on the widespread anti-Israel sentiment in much of academia that was twisted as a climate story. Even though you do the math, and this is really has nothing to do with climate.
So it's interesting. I think in a conversation between you and Richard Dawkins, you talk about the weaponization of science via different political parties, and that it's terrible for science that it has become politicized. Has that changed in your lifetime, and how is science politicized today?
Hard to tell. I think it may have gotten worse. There's a certain number of scientific issues that become kind of flashpoints in the culture war and become politicized. It's usually bad both for the world and for science when that happens, climate change being one of them, where you go back 40 years ago, 30 or 40 years ago, when climate change first appeared in the public domain, it wasn't terribly politicized, but at some point it became a right-wing cause to deny it or to deny its significance, and a left-wing cause to catastrophize. So it's the denial of the enormous evidence that human activity has been warming the planet has very little to do with scientific literacy, that in fact, on tests of scientific knowledge, the deniers know as much science as the believers. The only thing that differs is politics. Farther to the right, more climate denial. Likewise, when it comes to evolution, particularly the evolution of humans, it is not a question of not understanding evolutionary biology. The people who agree that humans are products of natural selection, no kind of diddly squat about evolution, but they're just on the political left. And so you're allowed to believe that if you're on the left, you're not allowed to believe it on the right. And we saw that during COVID, where vaccine denial, which formerly was mainly a kind of left cause, suddenly switched to the right. On the other hand, especially early in the pandemic, the widespread closures and extended closures of schools became a kind of left-wing cause. The right people on the right opposed that. It's not always the case that the left is right and the right is wrong. Sometimes it's the other way around, but it's always bad for the science itself because what's true is true. It doesn't matter which side looks better, and we're best off if we just understand reality.
So despite the fact that you have people disagreeing with each other on both sides over things that are potentially objectively true, one thing people on both sides can agree on is that a lot of them have problems with you on whether it's the far right, the far left, anywhere else. What is it that you study that's so controversial? What is it that you've said that has made you a controversial academic figure?
Well, a number of things. I believe that there's such a thing as human nature in an intellectual culture that embraces the blank slate. That is the idea that there's no such thing as human nature and that all of our ways of learning and knowing and feeling and interacting just come from culture and parenting and the media. But I believe we're product. I've argued that we are products of evolution, that we are, that there are certain traits that you find in all humans, that some of the variation among people has genetic causes, is not due to just to differences in how your parents treated you. I think men and women aren't indistinguishable. There's a lot of overlap in almost any trait you want to measure, but on average, men and women aren't exactly the same. I've argued that we have violent impulses, that our tendency to fight and kill and rape and enslave isn't just something that we're socialized to do, but rather just come from the fact that evolution is a competitive process. Maybe somewhat paradoxically, I've also argued that despite the fear that if you believe in human nature, you must be some kind of reactionary who thinks there's no point in trying to make the world a better place because you can't change human nature, I have argued, again, controversially, that life has gotten better, that we actually have improved the human condition, that we live longer, we kill each other less, we fight in fewer wars, there's less rape, there's less domestic violence, there's less child abuse, there's less starvation and poverty than there used to be, not because I'm an optimist, the world doesn't care whether I'm an optimist or pessimist, but because that's what the data show. But surprisingly, that's controversial too, that people look at all the horrible things that are reported in the news and they conclude, oh, things must be getting worse. What about the war in Gaza? What about hunger in Yemen? And it's true, there are terrible things that go on, but what people forget is a few years ago, there were more terrible things that went on. And you can only see that by putting aside the headlines and looking at the graphs, looking at the data. But there is a cognitive bias against doing that. People are vulnerable to what sometimes called the availability bias. Namely, if you can think of an example that pops into mind from memory, you think that it's really, really frequent. And you forget all of the things that aren't reported in the news and all the things that everyone has forgotten about from years past. And so we're kind of wired for nostalgia because we remember how bad everything is now. We don't remember how bad things used to be. And so people mistakenly think things are getting worse even when they get better.
So it's interesting. I remember from our college years and after that your books, Better Angels, Enlightenment Now, which are sort of the pinnacle of modern Enlightenment thinking. Bill Gates loved them. So many people, they were huge hits. And it was pretty uncontroversial. As you said, people looked at life expectancy charts. They looked at violent crime trends. They looked at infant mortality trends, economic trends, all of them. And you say the world has improved. There's progress, even though we don't like to think it. But now it feels, for whatever reason, that just in this short window of time, they have become more controversial. How has that made you feel? Are you more cynical now than you were then? Do you also share the belief that we're backsliding? What's your take on your change perception?
Well, in some ways, there has been some backsliding, and none of these trends are, they're certainly not linear. I mean, that would be a miracle. nor are they, to use a jargon word, monotonic in the sense that they always go up. All of them show wiggles and backslides. And we're by some measures, we're in one of them now, that deaths in war are worse now than they were 10 years ago. There's been some backsliding of democracy, wiping out about 20 years of progress, not taking us anywhere near the levels that were true in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Things are still way better, even with some backsliding. But the claim is not that everything always gets better everywhere. I mean, that would be a miracle, and that's not the way it works. So in some ways, things do keep getting better. That is, life after the blip from COVID, life expectancy has resumed its upward drift. Global poverty continues to decrease. Not everything always gets better. What we don't know is in cases where, say, there has been improvement and where there's been a little bit of a regression, does that mean that it's just a blip and the progress is going to resume? Does it mean it's going to beginning of a crash? And of course, no one can really predict that. I don't think it's that we're in a cycle, because there is nothing in history that oscillates in cycles. So I'm pretty sure it's not that, but there can be rude shocks, catastrophes, massive, unpredictable backsliding.
Do you think backsliding is some of what we're seeing in academia right now? You've been outspoken about free speech on campus in Harvard. We were listening to an interview on the way here, in which you said, you know, it's one of the lowest ranking places in the country for academic freedom of academic expression, speech, and so on. Why do you think that's happened? What forces are driving that? And is it going to change anytime soon?
Yeah, that is something where things have gotten worse, just measured, again, not based on impressions, but on, you know, counting. So incidents of professors being fired, students being expelled, articles being retracted, speakers being disinvited. It has definitely gotten worse over the last 5 years. With the Great Awakening, a play on the Great Awakening of the 19th century. It's hard to know whether there's some external factor that is responsible for this. Some people blame social media, possible. Some people blame the pandemic, where there's less face-to-face interaction, and so it's easier to trash someone when you're not, as opposed to debating with them, if you can just dump trash talk into social media and you're not seeing the reaction of the person. It could be just some ideas catch on and have a momentum of their own, or that there are certain generational dynamics. We do know that the repression of speech is more favored the younger you go. So there's a kind of a generational gradient. Why exactly? It's hard to pinpoint. One other hypothesis that's been thrown out there is that the culture of both of overprotecting children, that is, no supervised play in which kids can resolve disputes, but helicopter parents hovering the entire time, and protecting kids against any possible harm, has made them think of any disagreement as hurtful, harmful, something that must be prevented. That's the hypothesis of Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, for example. There's also a long-standing cultural trend of a culture of victimhood, where in different historical eras, people get kind of kudos, brownie points, prestige, status from different qualities. For a long time, and still in some parts of the world, there's a culture of honor, where your reputation counts, your willingness to avenge any insult or affront. Someone says something bitchy about you, you challenge them to a duel. That kind of culture.
Let's bring it back.
Yeah.
Bring back the duel.
And that gave way in most of the West over a long span to what's called a culture of dignity. That is a mature adult, a gentleman, doesn't go haywire if someone gives them a dirty look or says something nasty, but kind of brushes it off. That's what a mature person does. And that rose for a long time. But now we're in a culture of victimhood where no matter how good your life is, how exalted, you are only taken seriously, only considered a moral person if you're a victim. And so you have things like, you know, a British princess saying, you know, she's a victim and we're supposed to feel sorry for her. But that's how people gain brownie points now. Now that, you know, often means that on campus, if you can find ways in which you're a victim, that someone says something that, you know, harms you, that is, you disagree with it, then there's widespread support for considering yourself a victim and for punishing the harm doer.
On the subjects of the politicization of science and free speech at Harvard, we interviewed Dr. Martin Koldorf recently, who's fired from Harvard Medical School. I don't know how familiar you are with the details of that case, but did you think that was an example of a lack of free speech? Do you think that was a wrongful firing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a somewhat borderline case because he was also a physician in charge of their patients and part of a medical unit during a period of great uncertainty. Still, I think it's, especially since that, you know, some of the things that he advocated might very well be true, namely that people are who have already contracted COVID have an immunity that is, that makes vaccination unnecessary, that might even be stronger than vaccination, is, you know, could be true, might be true. And the thing is, no one knows what's true unless you actually get to say it and get to evaluate it. And so I think it was unwise for him to have been fired.
Well, it seems like that. I mean, one thing you've been very critical of in the past is kind of like this conspiracist thinking, you know, which you see all over society now. But it also seems like, you know, what's going on with that silencing of conversation, it just feeds that, right? Because people say, well, if they can't talk about this,
yes,
then what else can't we talk about?
This is
about
what they don't want you to know.
Exactly.
And the thing is, you know, the kooks might be right in that they don't want you to know it, but it might be better off if you did know it so you could laugh it off once the evidence was presented.
So do you, I know you're such an ideas person, but more of a personal question, has your speaking out against the Great Awakening and in campus speech repression at Harvard and other elite universities, has that made you a pariah on campus? Have people changed the way they treat you here?
No. I've got to say, I've got to give credit to my colleagues and the administration at Harvard. I've had an excellent relationship with all of our presidents and deans and department chairs, and yeah, not at all. So,
do you like a fight?
No.
You seem not. You're Canadian.
I'm Canadian. Yeah. Exactly. Yes, I'm very polite. But no, I don't, not particularly. And I think I do have a taste for positions that I think I can defend that not that many people hold, where I just think that I have something to offer by encouraging people to think twice and to consider an idea that is unpopular. Not because unpopular ideas are necessarily true. I'm not a contrarian in that sense. But sometimes I think there's just something that's kind of neglected, that's ignored. There are people who have not looked carefully enough, and that when they do, they come to a different conclusion, and I tend to pounce on those. Now, that can set me up for a fight, but I don't enjoy the fighting, no.
So, you know, right now, you have so many young people in particular who feel like the world is stacked against them. When they look at whether it's, you know, college debt, whether it's the high cost of owning property, which a lot of people think they can't even do. You know, people who really want to substantially change the status quo in the country on both sides of the political spectrum. What do you think they're missing?
Well, actually, I think they have a point. I think there are a number of policies that are stacked against younger people. We've got, you know, enormous income transfer from the young to the old in the form of Social Security and Medicare that are not particularly means tested. So it's not a question of rich supporting poor. But young supporting old, I don't think that can be defended. We've got laws and policies that work against younger people, including laws against building stuff. So you got fixed housing stock, you have more people now than there used to be, that's going to drive up prices. And you have other policies that make it worse, such as, you know, minimum lot size. So you have to have single family homes where, you know, duplexes or apartment buildings would be, you know, more efficient and more young people could buy condos. You've got a thicket of regulations originally applied to for environmental reasons, but have become an excuse for NIMBYism, not in my backyard, or what's sometimes called banana, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything, and that's going to work against younger generations. You've got an extraordinary hyperinflation in university costs, some of which is difficult to prevent, but some of which can be prevented. There's licensing requirements where it's hard for people to go into a career because the incumbents impose onerous licensing requirements, probably to protect their market. So I think young people, there are some things that are stacked against them that ought to be reformed.
You've noticed a lot of students pass through this university, MIT, where you were previous to Harvard. How have college students changed in the last 30 years?
Yeah, I've noticed more of a change in the last 5 years than over 30 years. One is they've lost their sense of humor. I find that maybe I'm just getting older and less funny,
yeah.
And I've got to admit that. But people don't laugh in lecture anymore, and I've compared notes with some of other lecturers who report the same thing. It's like, that's not funny. I think these aren't things that get dated, but I think rather the very idea that you can laugh about racial tension, about sex, about beauty, about men and women's relationships with each other. Everything is so politicized, and there's so many eggshells and triggers that younger people just don't know when it's okay to laugh. And comedians have also reported this, that they often will avoid college campuses because invariably someone will be enraged at a joke. But I found that things that would reliably get a laugh year after year after year, and suddenly silence. So that's one thing. And it's a kind of a general, I think it's consistent with data suggesting that I'm not blaming younger generations. I think it's the fault of a lot of the campus life administrators who've made student life a lot less fun. Because their bias response lines. You tell an off-color joke. You never know whether one of your fellow students is going to snitch on you. There's microaggression training. You ask someone where you're from, and then you're a racist. God forbid, you might use the wrong pronoun. A lot of the ways that people get pleasure and satisfaction and reduce tension in life is you sit back with some friends and you have some naughty humor, maybe a couple of drinks. You can't do that by rules that older people have imposed on younger people, meaning that just the social interactions, which is what makes life worth living, are no longer available. So it's perhaps unsurprising that there is, paradoxically, a mental health crisis in, pardon me for saying, but in people who've never had it so good, in the sense that students come here, they don't have to work for a living. These aren't students who have to be at a cash register at Safeway or pump gas. They don't have kids to drop off at daycare and worry about kids getting sick. So they're kind of carefree, fed three meals. Course requirements have gone down. There are fewer and fewer hours of reading. Because of grade inflation, it's easier and easier to get an A. Surrounded by, you can stream any music, any movie you want. It's like, why are they walking on air? Why are they over the moon? And I think it's because a lot of things that make people happy, namely uninhibited social interaction, have been taken away from them.
Given all this, do you think a Harvard degree is worth less now than 10, 20 years ago?
Hard to know. In the last few months, a Harvard degree has gone down in status. There's a number of cartoons and jokes about it. I have a collection of them, like a bumper sticker, "My son didn't go to Harvard," or an employer looking at a resume and saying, straight A grades and lots of volunteer activities, didn't go to Harvard, let's hire him, all of that. So that's because of Harvard has had particular misfortunes. But on the other hand, status and prestige aren't erased overnight. They can definitely erode, as in the cliche. This is the Cadillac of radios, and an era which Cadillac was like the just had a reputation as the most prestigious car. Now, you know, Cadillac isn't the Cadillac of cars even, but it shows that the brand, the Cadillac brand, went down. The Harvard brand could go down, hasn't yet, and one of the reasons is that too many employers use the Harvard sheepskin as a quick and dirty way of hiring people. Passing over students who might be smarter and harder working, who just happen to go to Ohio State or someplace else. I think it's tremendously unfair, even though my students are beneficiaries of it. As long as the consulting companies, the finance companies, use a Harvard degree as a signal, as an indicator of intelligence and discipline, then the degree will.
Do you take what you notice among Harvard students and young college students today as almost a critique of your Enlightenment Now hypothesis, where things on their face are so good, they're going so well, everything, the table's set for you to be happy, and yet you're unhappy? And so if not a critique, expose your large argument as incomplete, or what would you add to say why are these people unhappy, and reconcile it with your Enlightenment Now thesis?
Yeah, well, Enlightenment Now thesis is a big picture thesis. And, you know, if you have a world in which people are living to 70 instead of 30, in which less than 1% of babies die instead of 30% of babies die, then the fact that some Harvard students are anxious is kind of a small price to pay. You got to keep things in perspective. You know, I look at the bigger things first. But what it does show is that solutions sometimes create new problems. They always create new problems. Hopefully, the new problems are less severe than the old problems. But none of the progress is a miracle. It's not that you should expect everything always to get better. Things get better only to the extent that people try to make them better. That is, people recognize a problem, try to solve it, keep the innovations that work, try not to repeat their mistakes. That's the only thing that makes progress happen. And it can't work everywhere all the time. Some things also involve trade-offs, that where we might get more of one thing and pay for it in some other way, just because that's the way life works. So if you have more freedom, for example, people can define their lives. They don't have to go into their father's occupation. They don't have to live in their same small hometown. Their parents don't pick their spouse. Don't have to suffer if their family is involved in a scandal. All these things that hung over people for most of history. So we're free, we're autonomous. On the other hand, that also means that we can be confused. It can mean that we can be anxious about the choices that face us. It can mean that we have the freedom. Freedom also means the freedom to screw up your lives. We can get addicted. We can make stupid choices. Now, would we want to go back to a life in which, say, there's less of a chance of getting divorced because your parents probably know better than you who you should marry? We probably wouldn't want to go back to that time, even if it meant fewer divorces. We pay for some progress in some areas with costs in other areas.
So,
can I mention another thing?
Yes.
Another case in which you've got trade-offs is that when you make people richer, the rich are going to get richer faster and more than the poor, because let's say you multiply, and inequality is bound to increase. So if everyone gets, say, three times as rich, then people who start off rich are going to be richer still, and there's going to be a bigger gap. Likewise, if you have more freedom to choose careers, freedom to innovate, some people might think up things that are extraordinarily popular. J.K. Rowling might write the Harry Potter novels and get stupendously rich. It's probably good that she was able to do it, but that's going to increase inequality because she's a billionaire and you and I aren't. But we might want to live in a world with greater inequality if it also provides greater opportunity and freedom.
So there's so many things we want to discuss, but I think one is you've actually talked about the news, which is obviously relevant to what Roka is doing. And one of our founding principles is the news today is relentlessly negative, and you argue there's a cognitive bias. Also, just the sheer nature of news. It's what's happening, not what's not happening. And you've cited the example of nobody's ever going to go to a country and say, congratulations, 40 years without a war.
Yeah.
You'll never get that headline. News has also become more negative, more polarized. There are many reasons why. What's your sort of analysis of the state of the news?
Yeah.
Our podcast is named We the 66. 66% of Americans don't trust the news today. Why is that, and what's wrong with news right now?
Yeah, a couple of things. One of them is the, I think, too much focus on events as opposed to trends, that I think, and too much statistical illiteracy, that when something is covered in the news, I think it would be wise for it to, that as part of the context, and of course, all stories are presented with context, but the context should be how severe a problem is it? If there's a terrorist attack, how many people are killed by terrorists compared to people who are killed in, you know, ordinary barroom fights? Or how many people are killed in school shootings? How many people are killed by cops? People have wildly inaccurate perception just because of the amount of coverage. You know, likewise, a plane crash versus car crashes. You're much more likely to get killed in a car crash, but people fear plane crashes because they get so much more coverage. So I think there should be more awareness among journalists in the impression they create by focusing on the gaudy, the gory, and how that's going to misinform their readers, given that we tend to estimate frequency by salience, coverage, availability. That would be one. Another is that I think in addition to that built-in bias in the news, because news is about stuff that happens, not stuff that doesn't happen, there is, I think, a moralistic bias among many journalists. And this has been shown that in studies where if you give editors the same story and it's just framed optimistically or pessimistically, they'll go with a pessimistic framing. I've heard news journalists say that bad news is journalism, good news is advertising, or is you know, propaganda, like, you know, Soviet Union 5-year plan is resulting in an increase in the production of pig iron, and so there's kind of an allergy to recording progress. Because journalists tend to take an adversarial stance against government, industry, technology, commerce, you know, as they should to some extent. But if it's simply a question of, we want journalists and people that we hang out with, you know, like academics and critics, to look good, and we want the kind of people we don't hang out with, like people in tech and industry and law enforcement, to look bad, which I think drives some of that this coverage, then again, you're going to distort people's understanding. And if you're a good journalist, you want people to understand the world better, not worse.
Well, one thing that's in the news this week is the situation at NPR, where I think you even may have tweeted about it.
Yeah.
Today. And when you look at an institution like that, and you see that there is a deep ideological bias within the organization, and you wonder at what point that's going to change, because as this goes on, right, it puts us in these more and more tribal and arguably stupid communities, right, where we refuse information that doesn't conform with our worldview, and we get deeper in that rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's a profound problem. I agree that the media are getting more kind of self-branded as being on the left or the right. And then each one fears the bias from the other guy, and so they've got to double down and become even more biased as a kind of counterweight. And as you noted, confidence in the media is sinking. And but the fear is that if anyone is too balanced, like, you know, God forbid we should, you know, say something that might seem like it's nice about Donald Trump, oh my God, then people are going to vote for Trump, and the country's going to really be screwed. And, you know, kind of, I share that sense. On the other hand, it absolutely is better if we know the truth about everything, and if news outlets at least aspire to be as objective as possible and not get kind of carried away with their own political passions.
So what happens psychologically when you get into an intense partisan, into a tribe, whether that's, you know, a political party or something else? How does that kind of affect the brain and the way you process information?
Well, we know actually from studies that it interferes with your ability to do logic and math. That is, you give logic logic questions to people. Does this premise follow from the conclusions? Where the content it shouldn't matter if you're just doing logic. It's just a question of, P implies Q, P therefore Q. But, P implies Q, Q, no, not therefore P. Stuff like that. It shouldn't matter what the P and Qs are. In fact, we know it does matter psychologically. That is, people will say that P implies Q if they want Q to be true, even if P doesn't imply Q. Likewise, in statistics, do these data show that gun control works or not? Does it show that capital punishment works? If you're on the left, you'll hallucinate data that the data show that gun control works and capital punishment doesn't. If you're on the right, you'll hallucinate the opposite, even if you're statistically sophisticated and you're just looking at numbers. And of course, not everyone all the time, but that is people's reactions. So yeah, politics makes you stupider both in logic and in statistics. And it's just a bias that we should all be aware of, in the same way that every student who takes intro psychology, sociology, political science, first thing they're taught to avoid various fallacies, like don't generalize from a small sample and correlation isn't causation. But another one is mistrust conclusions that fit too clearly with your own politics, and realize that you're going to want your political convictions to be validated, and they may not legitimately be.
Do you think that there's a culture of self-censorship amid all these fears about, you've discussed cancel culture, which I think is a term that's been used as a bludgeon, maybe incorrectly, but it's a reality. And do you think at elite institutions, whether the New York Times, NPR, Harvard, a culture of self-censorship exists?
Oh, unquestionably. You just ask people. They say, I self-censor.
Yes.
So.
What are the consequences of that?
Well, we're going to be collectively deluded about certain ideas that might be true, but no one's willing to say. There are two fears.
Do you self-censor?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think it's, there are cases where I don't think you have to share your opinion about everything. I think if you're a journalist, if you're an academic, if you're a scientist, in general, you ought to say things that are true. And if there's some things that you want to keep to yourself, you shouldn't say the opposite. You shouldn't lie about them. But, there can be discretion. But I think that there's way too much self-censorship. And so the two problems, one of them is we might believe things that are false and encourage other people to believe things that are false. The other is that we sap our own credibility. That is, when people get a sense that news outlets or academics or public health agencies are kind of bullshitting, then they lose credibility even when they're right. People won't believe them. And I've said this is a big problem when it comes to things like climate, where, for example, people that I know on the right will say, in response to my saying that there's an enormous scientific consensus that human activity is warming the planet, and they'll say, consensus. Why should we trust the consensus? Everyone knows that you say something unpopular, you get canceled. And they kind of have a point. We erode our own credibility when we have a culture of censorship and cancellation, and so that even when we say things that are true, people don't have grounds for believing us. So that is another danger.
You, and I know you've spoken about this, have been, subject to your own conspiracy. The fact that you're close with Bill Gates, or at least that Bill Gates is a huge fan of your books. I think he dubbed both Better Angels and Enlightenment Now his favorite or the most inspiring books.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Which is incredible. He's obviously the subject a lot. And we wanted to say this just because I imagine you want to speak to it. A lot of people look you up and see a picture with you and Jeff Epstein. What was, first of all, so there were a couple times you're photographed with him. What was Jeff Epstein like?
A number of my colleagues kind of were real palsy-walsy with him, which is why I ended up in that photo. Some of my colleagues at Harvard, he gave money to Harvard. Other universities where I'd go to a conference and he bankrolled the conference. So I kind of ended up with him. I couldn't stand him. I thought he was even before his sexual crimes came out, I thought he was a bullshitter. I thought he was a kibitzer. I didn't think he was intellectually serious, though he wanted to be, I think, just so that he could hang around with smart and influential people. So I kind of tried to stay away from him, but I kept finding myself in the same room with him because he paid for the conference that I was invited to, or the Harvard event, or the TED party, or whatever.
You know, we obviously have gone after the Great Awakening and other ills of the ideological left today. I think on the ideological right, there's a similar Salem witch trial phenomenon taking place, where if you were photographed with Bill Clinton or Bill Gates, that all of a sudden you're part of the World Economic Forum reptilian cult. That's
yes, right. And I've been to the world. I mean, maybe I shouldn't confess this, but I've been to the World Economic Forum.
You know, these cameras are rolling now.
Yes, yeah. Right. I mean, you know, they don't really, you know, run the world and people. It's actually a pretty it's just like the kind of things that you would, you know, read in the New York Times or hear on NPR. It's certainly not kind of a neoliberal conspiracy, at least in my experience. Anyway. But it is a convenient symbol. It used to be the Trilateral Commission, which no one has heard of anymore. But the great cabal between academia, government, finance, and industry.
Are there any conspiracy theories that you endorse or are?
You know, sometimes people, you know, more than one person colludes on trying to achieve some outcome. So yeah, I mean, sometimes. Institutions try to prevent an embarrassing fact from becoming public, but conspiracy theories that are present the world as wildly unlike what it looks like, that the moon landing was faked, or that COVID was deliberately engineered as a bioweapon, that vaccines are microchips designed to surveil us, things that are wildly unlike what common sense would seem, are extraordinarily unlikely, just because there have to be so many moving parts that work perfectly. There has to be no one who betrays the conspiracy, no blunders that cause it to fail or bring it to light. The probability is extraordinarily against all of those things happening. And in a lot of these conspiracies, they are carried out by sinister, all-powerful forces. We know that when there are sinister, all-powerful forces, like, you know, the Stasi in East Germany or the KGB in the Soviet Union, people don't talk about them on street corners and bars in the New York Times because they fear they're going to get, you know, thrown in jail if they do. The fact that people talk about them so freely suggests that the degree of power and secrecy and control that they have is extraordinarily unlikely. Otherwise, they go after those people.
I've got one more question before a rapid fire round, which is, a lot of people believe in God who are religious, and you're of course a prominent atheist, have moments of doubt where they themselves are agnostic or they doubt the belief in God. Have you, as an atheist, in all your studies and all your thinking, have you ever had doubts and thought maybe there is a God?
You know, only in the meta sense that I've got to acknowledge that anything I believe could be false. I'm not, you know, omniscient. I'm not infallible. So you ask me, could I be wrong about any of my beliefs? And I have to say, yeah, I could be wrong about any of my beliefs, including that one. Do I think I am wrong about that one? No, just because there's no evidence. I always cite Bertrand Russell, who was asked a similar question. He says, what would happen if after you died, you discovered yourself at the pearly gates facing the Almighty, what would you say? And he said, I'd say, oh Lord, why did you not give me more evidence? So nothing I have seen would lead me to think that there is a divine creator and judge.
All right, rapid fire. Number one, you're an avid cyclist. What is the longest distance you've ever cycled?
101 miles.
Favorite movie?
Enemies, A Love Story by Isaac Bashevis Singer. Probably too obscure for most people. Yeah. It was a Hollywood release in its time.
So it's not a Marvel movie? Yeah.
It's not a Marvel movie. I guess among popular movies, it's North by Northwest by Hitchcock, one of them. Godfather 1 and 2, though not 3, by Coppola. The Last Waltz by Scorsese, the band's final concert with their friends. Those would be some of my favorites.
Who do you enjoy to spar with intellectually?
Oh, let's see. Neil Ferguson, Larry Summers. Geez, who else? There are others who aren't popping to mind, but people were. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed my conversation with him. Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
We thought that was an interesting debate.
Yeah. There are probably others who aren't occurring to me. People who are don't try to use kind of personal insult as a debating trick, and who are genuinely interested in getting to the truth and are willing to probe and challenge ideas kind of as part of a collective effort to find out what's...
And finally, favorite comedian.
Oh, wow. Let's see. Well, Richard Pryor, who was in his prime, would be up there. From my childhood watching Ed Sullivan, there's a guy named Alan King, one of the kind of great Jewish Borscht Belt comedians.
I don't know Alan King.
Yeah, I know. I think for forgotten, but funny in his day. I found him funny as a kid.
Maybe your
Robin Williams in his prime. And again, there are probably others. Yeah. Amy Schumer in her.
Yeah.
Better moments.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Great answer.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pinker.
My pleasure.
Wonderful to talk to you.
Honor. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right. Thank you.
All right. That was Steven Pinker. What a conversation.
He has some radiant eyes. Striking
radiant
blue
eyes. And great flow.
Great flow.
Yeah.
Very, very, very impressive.
Very impressive. Covered a lot of ground. And it was interesting to talk to someone you've read for a long time and heard about. He's epitomized the type of Mr. Feel-Good Progress. So whenever anything's going wrong in the world, I've always been like, and I'm tired of this Steven Pinker BS. And now we finally get to talk to him.
What an honor.
Okay.
So what do you have for me today, too?
So the new segment today is How Old Were They When? Are you ready for this?
Let's go for it.
Let's start with this one. How old was Colonel Sanders when he founded KFC?
27.
62.
Are you serious?
How old was Isaac Newton when he discovered gravity?
58.
23. How old was Isaac Newton when he lost his virginity?
16.
He never lost his virginity.
What? Are you serious?
How old was Rachel McAdams, allegedly, when she filmed the high school movie Mean Girls?
19.
26.
Are you serious?
And how old was King Tut when he became king?
4.
9.
Okay.
All right, that was pretty good. Well, you've been on a hot streak until that one. I can't believe you didn't know. All right, I got another one. Now, this is a little more down your alley, and it's not that creative, which I love, because this is a real test of knowledge. It's not like gimmicky knowledge. You need to know this. I want you to name the top 10 most populous countries in the world, and let's see how far you can go in order.
Okay. India, China, America, Indonesia, Pakistan, Brazil.
It was until very recently.
Bangladesh. Nigeria.
Nope. Yes, Nigeria. So India, China, U.S., Indonesia, Pakistan, Nigeria.
Okay. Brazil.
Yep.
Bangladesh.
Yep.
Mexico.
Is 10.
Okay.
What's number 9? I'll give you a hint. It's been in the news a lot lately.
Iran? No, Iran's like 80 million people.
No. Big fella. We're talking a big fella here. A big fella. I mean, this country's got some land. It's got some ice.
Oh,
it's
Russia.
Got some shirtless Russia, leaders. Russia, there Russia. You go. Where you've been, brother? And all right, we got one final segment, which is there are 9 states with more cows than people. Okay. Can you name 5 of them without getting one wrong?
Okay. Idaho.
Correct.
South Dakota.
Yes.
North Dakota.
Correct.
Nebraska.
Yes. Don't screw up. If you say New Jersey, I will disown you as a friend.
Iowa.
Bingo. Well done.
Can
Not
I try to get the rest? How many are left?
And keep going. 4. Because 9 minus 5 is 4.
Wyoming.
Correct. Three left. I think you have a shot at getting these.
Did I say North Dakota yet?
Yeah. You got the Dakotas.
Oklahoma?
Two more. This guy's going for nine.
Arkansas?
No!
Oh, I should have known. That's not Derek.
Kansas and Montana.
Kansas, dude. Kansas. Oh, man, that's bad.
All right. So that was Steven Pinker. He's kind of like Mr. Brightside of the academia world. Dr. Brightside. So there you go.
Those eyes Steven are certainly Pinker, Dr. Brightside.
Wow, you're really jerking by his eyes.
I like those eyes.
So there you go. Huge thanks to Steven Pinker. Keep sending us recommendations on who you want us to talk to, and we will see you on Tuesday.
Thank you for listening.